thank you so much for jumping in, Jameson. I'm really excited to talk through this topic. I've followed you for a long time. I know we've had a lot of different interactions over the past few years, but it seems like you're pushing a little harder on this ossification subject and the idea of making calm, rational changes to Bitcoin to make sure that it can continue to fulfill the goals that I think at least people like us have for it. And I thought it'd be a great time to just sit down and chat through a lot of this, because this topic of ossification, which we'll define when we get into it, this topic of making protocol changes to Bitcoin, better privacy, better scalability, all this stuff has been talked about relentlessly over the years. And a lot of the things that I was promised when I got into the space don't seem like they've come to fruition, at least as they were promised. So as there's been kind of a revival around this concept of, can we make changes to Bitcoin, specifically with covenants, I think it's a really good time to dive into just this topic in general. So I'm excited to talk about ossification, protocol changes, a lot of different things with you today. But before we get too deep into that, why don't you just introduce yourself? I know you haven't been on the show before, and my audience is not a like Bitcoiner only audience. So they may not know you. So I'd love for you to just introduce yourself, tell people who you are, and then we'll dive into the topic at hand.
Well, that's okay, because I'm not a Bitcoin owner cypherpunk, a Bitcoin only guy, that is. I mean, and that's why I get canceled sometimes. I'm Jameson Lopp. I've been in the Bitcoin space for a decade now, full-time, focused on security, self-custody, and in general, just doing a lot of research side projects. So I'm always just trying to understand Bitcoin better and try to figure out where we're going. And so, you know, I'm a technical guy, computer science background. I'm the chief security officer at Casa, where we basically focus on helping high net worth individuals set up extremely robust multi-sig self-custody. And I guess the short version of a lot of why I do what I do is I feel like, you know, Bitcoin is fundamentally a collaborative open project. And so the most important thing that we can do is continue talking about it, researching it, discussing it, and proposing ways to improve it. So I guess you could say that I see ossification as kind of an existential crisis to one of the fundamental strengths of the project.
Yeah, I definitely understand that. And I think something that would be helpful here, if you don't mind just kind of defining how you view ossification, and specifically if there are like natural and unnatural types of ossification. Because that was something that was really interesting that you brought up in your debate with Jimmy Song in Lugano, which I was able to go back and watch. Was that there's like natural ossification that will happen and there's unnatural types that we can force into place. So maybe just define ossification and kind of hit on those two different ways that ossification can happen.
Right. So ossification from a dictionary term sense just means sort of calcification or turning to bone, making something more brittle and slowing down its flexibility and ability to grow and change. From a protocol perspective, I actually see this almost as a law of network physics. And that basically means that when you have a protocol, which is just a fancy technical way of saying a shared communication language in order to accomplish some specific task, that protocol, the value of it grows as the network grows, as the number of entities using the protocol to speak the same language with each other grows. And as the size and the value of the network grows, it also becomes more and more difficult to coordinate changing the protocol. So, you know, you can almost think of it as like, you know, how difficult would it be to make fundamental changes to the English language or, you know, any language that has a billion adopters? Those type of changes do sometimes happen organically over extremely long periods of time, but you can't just make sudden changes. Otherwise, it would be chaos and confusion, and people would no longer know how to talk to each other, and the value of the network would kind of drop off a cliff. So this we have seen play out with network protocols like TCP/IP, like SMTP, email protocol, really any of these fundamental protocols that hit mass adoption with hundreds of millions or billions of people using them tend to ossify. So this is the natural progression, I think, of a network kind of collapsing under its own weight. It becomes unable to change because everyone understands that trying to do so would be a net negative for the value of the network. And what we're talking about these days with Bitcoin ossification is almost more of an artificial, preemptive, accelerated ossification of saying that, well, Bitcoin ain't broke, don't try to fix it. There are unknown unknowns, and any change that you make could have negative consequences. Therefore, we should stick with what we know, stop changing the Bitcoin protocol, and just kind of declare it ossified, even though there's no one who can declare it ossified. Due to the sort of game theory and governance of Bitcoin as a protocol, if enough people are apathetic and going to veto or not participate in upgrades and changes, then it's certainly possible for a preemptive ossification to happen.
Yeah, so the inevitable is ossification at some point. The conversation right now is more around, do we want to force ossification faster than the weight of the network itself would cause it to happen? Or do we want to understand that we literally cannot stop ossification at some point, but take the chance now before that natural ossification happens, that hardening of the consensus changes, if we want to take advantage of that right now to continue to improve the protocol? And we're in this gap right now where we do have the chance to still do that. It feels harder and harder. Like, I feel like that natural ossification, since I got into Bitcoin in 2017, I'm a little bit of a late bloomer when it comes to the terms of when we got into the space. But it seemed like there was a lot more openness at that point. Obviously, there were the block size wars, and that was not a consensus change that went through. But there was a lot more kind of discussion and ideation over what could happen, seemingly leading up to that, and like kind of hit a wall. And it feels like in the last few years that I've been in the space, there hasn't been much progress. And do you feel like that is just the natural ossification? Like, we do have many more people in the space now in 2024 than we did in 2017. Or do you think that that's some sort of like narrative taking hold that's preventing people from having an interest in proposing changes or trying to get them through soft forks, et cetera?
So the block size wars, I think on their face, it was this debate about, do we prioritize the cost of transacting, or do we prioritize the cost of auditing the system and running a full node? But underneath that, I would say it was actually a war about the governance of the protocol. And on one side, it seemed like the quote-unquote big blockers were more in favor of giving miners more governance power in determining the future and path forward of the protocol, whereas the small blockers were more in favor of the independent node operators retaining more power. And I would say the independent node operator idea won out, and along with that seemed to come a fair amount of trauma, and the result was that we didn't even really have anyone seriously suggesting consensus changes for several years after that, and so then we did get the Taproot upgrade, but ever since then, even though we've had some proposals, a lot of the proposals have not come with proposed activation parameters. So it's like we still have a decent amount of brain power that's thinking about ways to improve Bitcoin, but few developers have the interest in becoming a consensus change champion and having to deal with all of the negativity that goes along with that.
Yeah, and I think we've seen that with even some of the big covenants proposals, like with CTV. You know, Jeremy Rubin tried to start pushing a little bit towards consensus change and propose some activation methods, and there was a kind of an all-out war against him as a result. And there was a lot of mess, and thankfully he's still in the space and still kind of ideating on how we can do covenants in smart and efficient ways. But there's definitely been a lot of examples of when people do propose activation methods, they get hit pretty hard for it. I know someone was proposing activation methods for L-Enhance a couple of days ago on Twitter, and was immediately called out by Bitcoin Core Dev as being an attack on Bitcoin because they were proposing activation methods, which is, that feels kind of like where we're at, is even just the idea of not even having people run the code, but even just saying this is how this could be activated is kind of violent attack somehow.
That's one of the fundamental disagreements that I had with the Bitcoin subreddit moderators 9 years ago, the early days of the scaling debates, was that they basically enacted a rule saying that you can't even talk about proposed forks, because that is detrimental to Bitcoin consensus, right? And I'm like, well, if we can't discuss proposed changes to Bitcoin, what are we even doing here, right? And so, I considered that a form of censorship. And at the time, I actually went to go become a moderator of the Bitcoin XT Reddit, which is one of the many reasons why people like to cancel me every now and then, because I dared go against the sort of mainstream consensus at the time. But it was less that I was like in favor of that particular block size increase BIP, and more that I felt like it was a negative way of maintaining healthy discussion in the space. And so I get it. I mean, the Bitcoin moderators have the whole thing about, if you don't kind of maintain some semblance of order within your walled garden, then it can, turn into wild weeds and overgrowth, and the sort of quality of the discussion can go down. But I think that it went down significantly just from that one rule, and they were a bit heavy-handed about that. But we have so many different platforms now that we can discuss things on, and kind of to your point, I think it's almost asking for trouble of even talking about proposed consensus changes on social media, because I mean the vast majority of people on social media aren't even really relevant or participating in consensus or technical consensus changes for the network.
Yeah, it can be maybe helpful to just find like rough community consensus, but even then, like if you're talking like Bitcoin Twitter, it's a tiny fraction of the Bitcoin ecosystem that's going to actively engage in a discussion around activation parameters for a covenant or something like that. It's interesting. I think like you talked about that censorship ultimately prevents finding consensus. If there's not a good way, and there's not an openness to just having the discussions, like having open, nuanced, calm, rational discussions. Like obviously I'm not saying anyone should just go crazy on either side and start attacking people. But if you can't have that calm, rational discussion, you're never going to find consensus. And ultimately you will then by default be choosing to leave Bitcoin as it is. If you have
it's also a problem with each platform. Every discussion platform has its own set of game theory. So, Twitter X, for example, with its short form, really prioritizes quick emotional reactions, dunking on people, kind of like it doesn't really matter if what you say is logical. Like if it emotes some sort of quick knee-jerk response, then it's going to get engagement and do well. And so that's the feedback loop that it creates of the type of interactions that you should expect to get on there. You know, Reddit is kind of similar with the upvote downvote system in the sense that if you go against the grain of what the terminally online Redditors are thinking, then you're just going to get downvoted into oblivion. And once again, the quick witty retorts that don't take much effort to read and parse and think through logically are going to outperform the longer form nuanced discussions. So I don't know, I'm kind of the mind that, you know, for those longer form nuanced discussions, the better platforms are, you know, mailing lists or potentially just, you know, simple linear discussion forums that aren't manipulated with upvotes, downvotes, likes, so on and so forth.
Yeah, I know Delving Bitcoin has been a really good resource that I've enjoyed following. I haven't actually contributed much to it, but that I've enjoyed following. That's had, I think, a lot better discussion than any other platform I've been on. I haven't followed the mailing list, but that's just because I feel like actually following a mailing list is very time consuming just in the format. So I haven't bothered too much with that, but Delving Bitcoin has been useful there. I want to kind of pull us back to why this discussion today. And it's felt like for a long time that we're kind of at a fork in the road in Bitcoin, where if we leave things as they are, there's general agreement, there's a very limited ability to support a good portion of the population on Bitcoin as it is today. Even when we're talking Lightning, I think the number that you gave in Lugano was 100 million. I know there's been different estimates, but I think 100 million is probably the most consensus that I've seen around roughly how many users we could support, even with using Lightning, because you still require Lightning channels for each of those users. And if we leave things as they are, we're necessarily choosing that we're going to limit who can access the base layer. And the bigger, or not bigger, but equally as important issue in my mind is that privacy on Bitcoin is obviously quite poor. I think you said in a podcast that we did while we were at the Plain B Forum in Lugano as well, was essentially like privacy is the antithesis of how Bitcoin was designed. It's designed to be transparent. It's designed to reveal all of this information to the world. And to go against that grain is incredibly difficult with the way that it's built today. And so we kind of have these two paths right now where self-custody is going to get more and more difficult. And privacy has gotten more and more difficult. Even just in this year, we've seen how much harder that has gotten and how app-level privacy is very vulnerable to state-level attacks. So those are kind of the two pillars that I view as core to freedom money. And it feels like we're kind of at a fork in the road where if we don't choose to improve those two things soon, that natural ossification is going to be too great. The weight of the network will be too great to be able to improve on those two things. I'm curious, what's the driver for you? Like I've heard you talk about this very loosely in the past, but I've never seen such a concerted effort from you to talk about this topic as I have at the Plain B Forum in Lugano and your blog post on X recently. So I'm curious, what was kind of the breaking point, if you will, or what's the main driver behind you wanting to kind of spark these discussions now?
I think the short version of it is actually Bitcoin's success and related to that, the institutions arriving. And so I think the problem that I'm foreseeing is really complacency because number go up. And I think people aren't thinking too critically about why number go up. I think the short version that should make it more obvious is look at the price charts right now. And then look at the activity in the mempool on the blockchain. Sir. Anyone who's been around for a cycle or two should find this odd. And why is it odd? It's because, in my opinion, all of the activity is going through a few centralized providers. It's going through the ETFs, the custodians, And a large portion of the inflows into, you know, Bitcoin as a monetary system are now happening through a few gatekeepers. And so they're not using many on-chain transactions. And, you know, this is a way of scaling Bitcoin. And in fact, you know, this was one of the first proposed ways to scale Bitcoin. Hal Finney talked about, I think, in the first few months of the network. He said, oh, we'll just create a bunch of Bitcoin banks and they will, you know, offload a lot of the on-chain transactions. And so, you know, there are many ways that we can scale Bitcoin, but if we're not continuing to make improvements at the protocol level, then I expect that the scaling of Bitcoin will come with the trade-offs of more centralization, less sovereignty, less privacy, in general, the continued erosion of several of the most valuable attributes of this network. And, you know, I put out some posts recently where I was basically saying that, you know, one of the things that should cause people concern is the fact that it's entirely possible for the Bitcoin exchange rate to go to the moon while we continue to erode these fundamental properties. And so that's why I think, you know, Bitcoin is an amazing system and it's gotten, you know, 15 years, almost 16 years so far, because the game theory and the incentives were all somewhat magically aligned. But I think that this is one particular area in the game theory where the incentives are not aligned optimally for the sort of the long-term health and longevity of the ecosystem. And so kind of tying that all together, I think that that actually can create a negative feedback loop where if we have more and more money and quote-unquote Bitcoin adoption coming in through a few centralized providers, that actually further disincentivizes the continued improvement and evolution at the protocol level. Why? Because nobody is going to care about the protocol because they're not using the protocol. To put this in context of one of my favorite network protocols to talk about, SMTP, I think if you ask the average person right now, you know, is email a global mass adoption success in terms of network protocols? And they would say, absolutely. You know, I use email every day. Everybody I know uses email every day. It has billions and billions of users. But if you're a really technical guy like me and you look at the actual architecture of email network and how people are using it, nobody is actually using the email protocol. The email protocol is used by probably a few hundred or few thousand entities. 90% of people who are using quote unquote email are actually using one of 10 centralized providers. That, you know, this is sort of one of the ways that email was scaled out. And, you know, that's a whole 40-year history that I've talked about of like how that happened, because it wasn't always that way. In the early days, lots of individuals, or, you know, almost every corporation ran their own email servers and they were, you know, running a quote unquote node on the email network. And over the decades, due to a variety of problems that came up, mostly around spam, the bar to operate as a sovereign email node on the email network got higher and higher and higher until we ended up with basically a dozen gatekeepers owning a supermajority of the network. And so the point being, I find the path forward of Bitcoin doing that same thing to be fairly likely if we're not out here screaming about it and trying to prevent it. And maybe it's all for naught. You know, maybe I undertake all of this and yell about it, and, you know, a few decades from now, we'll look back on my post and people will say, well, he was right, we should have listened to him, but oh well.
Hopefully that's not the outcome. Hopefully we can prevent the SMTPization of Bitcoin becoming something that's much more centralized. But I think you hit on a really good point there, that many people especially in this bull run, they're not actually using Bitcoin. And I run into this all the time of, especially when I'm talking with people about using the Lightning Network. I talk to people and they're like, Lightning is fantastic. It works perfectly for me. I never have any problems. Inevitably, when I get down to it, 99% of those users, I go, okay, what wallet are you using? And they go, oh, I'm using Wallet of Satoshi and I'm paying another Wallet of Satoshi user. Okay, yeah, you're not using Lightning. You're sending a transaction by just changing a field in a database. This is totally centralized. It's not actually using the Lightning Network. And this, it's kind of a growing theme. I've heard the same thing when people talk about privacy. They'll say, I'll just use an exchange to make payments and I'll pay from Coinbase. Because then I know that when I pay someone, they'll know that it came from Coinbase, but they're not going to know who it came from. They're not going to know the rest of my funds. They won't have any visibility into what I do. And I see this as a growing, quote unquote, solution that people see is I'll just use centralized providers. And I think even when we get into this kind of this promise that I was made by many of the loud voices in the space when I first got into Bitcoin, was basically there were two things. We'll build everything we need in layers, and anything that an altcoin, or I'm sure they use the terminology shitcoin, implements that's good, we'll bring it back into Bitcoin and we'll improve Bitcoin, and we won't need that altcoin. It'll just test what we need. We'll build it into Bitcoin. Unfortunately, neither of those things really happened. None of the stuff from other chains has been brought back into Bitcoin. And then scaling in layers has become increasingly difficult. All there is really today is Lightning. And Lightning is a fascinating technology and can be very powerful, but has also not been the self-custodial success that I think it was also initially pitched as, where actually scaling Lightning to individual users who actually have their own channel and hold their own keys has been minimal. And those promises haven't played out. And if we ossify, those promises only become harder and harder to happen. So yeah, it's just really interesting to see that where even in the last, I feel like 6 to 12 months, we've seen a shift in the Lightning space where Lightning's supposed to have solved these problems. Again, these are promises that were made to me on social media. I'm not saying that it was actually feasible, but there were promises that were widely talked about in the space when I got into Bitcoin. And yet now we see many Lightning wallet providers shutting down because they're having too many issues solving the problems of Lightning for their users. We're seeing a shift in focus to custodial solutions, whether they're full custodians, like in the traditional sense of Wallet of Satoshi, or they're custodians in the sense of an eCash mint, where people want privacy and they want a simple UX, so they give up custody to get that. And it all hits on the point that you made where people are not actually using Bitcoin, I would argue, because it's too hard to do so for self-custody in many scenarios, and it's too hard to do so privately. So people are looking for alternative solutions. And because we don't have good building blocks to build out things that help with self-custody and things that help with privacy on Bitcoin, that path seems to be the one that's been chosen. I know I kind of got into a lot and fell down a rabbit hole there, but any kind of thoughts around that, like that scale in layers idea? I know you, I'll bring it back into a concise question. So I know in your debate with Jimmy Song, one thing that you brought up that really struck me was you talked about if we don't make changes to Bitcoin that give more building blocks to developers, the scale in layers scenario becomes increasingly complex or even impossible to be able to scale out and build the things that we want. We're already seeing that with the limitations that Arc has, with the limitations that Spark has, with the ways that they're essentially having to hack around the lack of covenants. And we're already seeing that play out right now, which is even earlier than I expected to see that play out. But could you maybe dive into a little bit more of that idea of like, if we don't change Bitcoin, scaling in layers becomes increasingly complex or centralizes or introduces custody, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, pretty much all of these discussions come down to trade-offs, and a lot of it, especially if we're talking about how user adoption progresses, then often it's a trade-off between convenience and something else. Convenience and privacy, convenience and security. Convenience and complexity in navigating, you know, a higher bar of knowledge required in order to be able to operate, you know, sovereignly, or, you know, to actually use some of these protocols. So I would say over the past year, for example, we have seen a lot more quote unquote layer two Bitcoin projects, but I think it's important to look at them and analyze them to see, you know, what are the trade-offs that are being made. And so, you know, you did comment on eCash mints, you know, the trade-offs there being you can get really strong privacy, but generally with rug pull risk because you have a custodian running the mint. I think Fedimint improves upon that somewhat. So what I'm seeing, and like one of the reasons I keep talking about, one of the reasons we want better building blocks at the base layer, is because if you're building a layer two right now, then most likely you're either doing pegging into a custodian or a federation, which is not great, or if you want to make it more quote unquote permissionless and censorship resistant, you're having to come up with some crazy game theory. And one of my favorite examples, I don't know if you're familiar with the spider chain concept by Botanics, I'm not sure exactly how they pronounce it, but suffice to say that they've come up with this idea of sort of rolling cycles of multi-sig wallets that kind of act as the pegging slash staking layer in between the base chain and the second layer that they are building. And it's extremely complicated and it's hard to analyze the game theory. And this is one of the reasons why, you know, there's a number of, you know, kind of economic and technical parameters that are involved in all of this. And it's really hard to say what the optimal ones are. And so that's going to probably a multi-year process of them going through multiple phases to try to tease out how do we make this as secure as possible? Or, you know, if you look at BitVM, it's complicated. You're trying to do even fairly simple logic in a, you know, more permissionless manner. Has a lot of overhead. My favorite, though, was the one that just came out a week or so ago. The covenants with hash collisions. the short version is, yeah, we can do covenants on Bitcoin. The only caveat is you have to burn tens of millions of dollars worth of electricity doing proof of work in order to, you know, find some hash collisions. And so, look, that's really cool. Like, you totally nerded out on this idea and you proved that something is technically possible, but I don't care what's technically possible if it's impractical and infeasible to the point that I don't think that it's actually going to get much adoption. Like, we have to find the right path forward where the technical improvements and whatever we're building can actually be used. Otherwise, we're just kind of sitting around, you know, mentally masturbating, basically saying, oh, look at this really cool idea I came up with that nobody's ever going to use. So, you know, if we actually want to progress the ecosystem forward, we have to find the practical stuff. And so the way that I look at it, and I think it was actually Adam Back who used this term a number of years ago, but he said, you know, I look at the Bitcoin base layer as a cryptographic accumulator. And so I think that that makes a lot of sense in the context of second layers, especially if we're talking about the low level functions and operations that will be most useful in order to make building permissionless second layers easier for people. And basically that is, If there is some set of operations that is either impossible right now or requires you to do just a ton of gymnastics in order to recreate, but you can distill that down into like one opcode on the Bitcoin network, you know, that's where you have potential orders of magnitude of improvement of efficiency and developer friendliness that can then boost you know, accelerate the future development of the entire ecosystem. Like, that's how I think we should be looking at improvements to Bitcoin, is if it can greatly simplify the burden that we're currently putting on layer two developers, then it's something that we should be interested in. And so I wasn't able to go to the recent conference in Boston, Op Next, but you know, it looked like there was a lot of good discussions there. And one thing that I saw happening from some of the social media discussion was, you know, a lot of those layer twos, they're already building stuff, but they've done the analysis and they can show in many cases, you know, if we had this one opcode, it would greatly improve X, Y, and Z aspects of our second layer. And so, you know, that's why I'm in favor of things like opcat and, you know, re-enabling some of the old opcodes on Bitcoin. And I think that it's possible to do that safely. We don't need to be afraid of you know, edge cases if we build a proper safety framework around it.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And that part about like doing gymnastics essentially to build out these second layers is wild to see what they could look like. Especially like Arc is all the rage these days. Lots of people talking about it. Looking at the user experience that we could have with Simple Covenants and Arc, which is essentially enabling people to use Lightning in an easier way. So like it is expanding Lightning, allowing things like channel factories, has a lot of interesting use cases. Comparing that to the user experience of what you will have with Covenantless Arc is wild, because instead of being able to just use one or maybe two opcodes to commit to transactions only looking a certain way in the future, which is necessary for the Arc protocol to function smoothly, you have to do these massive pre-signed Bitcoin transaction collaborative things between all of the users and around and the Arc operator. And it gets crazy compared to what it could be, again, like you said, with relatively simple changes to the base layer, something like Opcat, something like OpCTV. And you can't assume that just because you can do something means that it will gain adoption. And the harder the user experience hurdle is to get over, the less likely it is to actually see use. And like the best case in these layer twos is generally that the user experience will be drastically worse than it could be with simple changes to Bitcoin. But in many of these examples, they actually lose the trustless nature that we come to accept with the base layer. Like normally our barrier of entry is, I want to be able to get funds out no matter what. And there are generally unilateral exits and things like Arc and Spark. But a lot of the things like anything, basically anything using BitVM for a bridge is not trustless. You need one operator or a threshold of operators to be good or to be apathetic for funds to not be lost or stolen. And you lose that trustlessness because you don't have ways to build layer twos that have those trustless bridges. And yeah, it gets really weird because it looks like we're like trying to scale in layers right now when we don't actually have the building blocks to do it in a way that's approachable from a user's perspective, or trustless or extremely trust minimized.
It's also ridiculous because we did three different forks to get Lightning Network enabled. There are some, I've seen some ossifiers say, well, we could have done Lightning Network without those things. And like, yes, you're technically correct. And it would have sucked even more. Like the game theory would have been even worse. You wouldn't have been able to have like infinitely long-lived channels and so on and so forth. And so like, once again, this is all about trade-offs. I did have someone was asking me recently, like how we should be thinking about making protocol changes going forward, because they felt like that something shifted where it used to be, oh, you know, we have this great idea for a future of things that we could build on top of it. And like, that's how we ended up saying, okay, we should add like these lock time opcodes, and we should fix transaction malleability so that we can do, Lightning Network channels and get all of those benefits. And it feels like, I think a lot of people are pushing back against the idea of us just enabling more building blocks without specifically saying, oh, okay, we're only doing it for this one use case. They're afraid that, like, there's so many use cases out there. Some of them might be bad. Some of them might be immoral. Somebody might get scammed because somebody, you know, builds a Ponzi scheme or you know, builds you know, some sort of pump and dump, call it NFT project, token project, whatever. You know, this is kind of tangential, but you know, this is. I've seen the what you might call like the Bitcoin Puritans or moralists overlapping a lot in the Bitcoin ossifier space of basically, you know, we basically want to gatekeep Bitcoin to only be what we consider to be pure monetary transactions. And if you're using Bitcoin for anything outside of what we deem to be appropriate, then you know, you're a shitcoiner and we don't want you on our network. And that has kind of seeped into the whole, how do we improve Bitcoin space to be greatly afraid of, well, if you can't prove that this change won't be used in a way that I disagree with, then I'll never agree, you know, to run it on my node. I don't know. I don't even really want to engage with those type of people in argument, and I'm hopeful that they're just a tiny vocal minority. But you know, it is a fundamental conflicting perspective, and I think how people see Bitcoin. You know, many people see Bitcoin in many different ways. And I've always been quite open about the fact that, you know, I'm a technologist and I see Bitcoin as a database. And, you know, there's a protocol around how you buy space in that database and make updates to it. And I'm kind of a hardcore, you know, free market maximalist that if someone finds a use case for block space that fits within the constraints of the protocol and they're willing to pay market rate for it, then they're not a spammer. They're just a consumer of block space. And the permissionless nature of the protocol is such that, you know, you don't get to gatekeep them. The only gatekeeping that happens is from an economic perspective.
Yep. They pay a fee. That's the core spam filter. Mempool policies aren't going to do it. You're not going to work around the game theory of privately passing a transaction to a miner. That's a whole nother can of worms, I feel like. But it is tied in, because like you mentioned, a lot of the pushback that I see as well is basically, well, we don't know what this could cause.
Yeah, yeah. Or, it's the unknown unknowns argument. And you know, that's one of, I don't think it came up specifically in my debate with Jimmy. He was smart enough not to go there because ultimately, and I put this in my article that I published later, the unknown unknowns argument actually cancels each other out, because there are always unknown unknowns. And so the ossifiers often say, you know, any change that you make has unknown unknowns. But what they're unwilling to admit, from what I've seen, because it's not convenient, is that not making changes also has unknown unknowns. And you know, trying to quantify that one is more than the other, I think it's naive, and it's actually ahistorical. Just look at what happened to email, for example. Not changing the email protocol had unknown unknowns that were unforeseeable, because what happened was the rest of the world changed as the protocol hit mass adoption. A lot of new problems came along and they had to get solved. And you know, one of the only people who tried to solve the spam problem at the SMTP layer was Adam Beck. But guess what? He got ignored. So I wonder if I'm going to, you know, end up being the Adam Back of the Bitcoin protocol in regard to, you know, this particular issue. I certainly hope not. But point being, I expect, you know, if Bitcoin ossifies, the world will continue changing. There will be more problems, and those solutions are going to get haphazardly bolted on generally in a centralized manner, and we're just going to end up with more gatekeepers.
Yeah, and I think too there are known problems that need to be solved. I would say, I think Jimmy used the terminology of imminent and necessary as his barrier. I would say the lack of privacy is imminent and necessary. We're seeing people targeted based on the on-chain activity that they had. Someone is now serving a sentence in jail because one transaction that Chainalysis says was his was used to buy a domain for a centralized mixer, which is a whole nother topic that there were centralized mixers because privacy was poor. But he is said to have done that because there was no privacy in between that. What seems to have happened, just as a side note, is that he traded Bitcoin peer-to-peer frequently. And it's very, very likely that at a Bitcoin conference, he bought Bitcoin from the operator of Bitcoin Fog and then had that link directly to the funds that that Bitcoin Fog operator then used, or sorry, he sold Bitcoin to that Bitcoin Fog operator. Bitcoin Fog operator used those to purchase what he needed. And the lack of privacy landed him in jail. I would say that that's pretty imminent and necessary that the average person has access to privacy to protect them from what, at least over the last 4 years, has been a clear attack against Bitcoin and against privacy and cryptocurrencies. Just like scaling, yes, maybe the fee market right now is ridiculously low, which is potentially a problem on its own, as you mentioned earlier, that we're hitting a bull run and no one's using the chain, which is an interesting combination that has, as far as I know, never happened before in the history of Bitcoin.
Yeah. And so actually I had a presentation in Lugano. I don't know if you saw my Blockspace economics presentation.
Not yet, sadly.
Yeah. And so this is another controversial topic that I'm sure will get me canceled by some people. But I believe another one of the very long-term problems that we should be thinking about with Bitcoin is block space, or you call it the block size debate. But I think that the block size debate of the 2015 to 2017 era was one thing. And I think that the block size debate of the future is going to be a very different thing. We've already decided on how we're prioritizing, low cost of on-chain transaction versus low cost of auditing the system. Like, that's already decided. I don't expect that to change. But what I do think will eventually become an issue will be fees, sustainable thermodynamic security, and cost of sovereignty, basically. Some people have said, well, should everyone be able to own their own UTXO? That's kind of its own debate. But my point from my presentation, that it'll probably be published in the next few months, was that I think that we should desire to have an adjustable block size that takes into account all the different stakeholders in the ecosystem, and prioritizes safety, of course, prioritizes node operators not getting priced out from auditing the system, but also prioritizes the economics of block space. And so, I would argue that right now the block size should actually probably be smaller than it currently is if we had an appropriate adjustable block size algorithm.
Yeah, it's a very interesting aside, but this is something that I've really liked about the game theory of Monero specifically. And it may not be the exact approach that you're mentioning, and I definitely want to see that presentation.
So I did mention Monero.
Oh, nice.
In my presentation, I went through every Bitcoin BIP related to block size, and I explained why they all sucked. And really, the only one that I said didn't suck was Peter Wulla's one that was based upon network bandwidth growth. I felt like that was an appropriate, safety-based one, but it still didn't take into account economics. And then I went out and I looked at, all of the other systems, or at least all of the other major cryptocurrencies that have adjustable block sizes, and tried to understand the game theory around them. And the only one that I thought didn't completely suck was actually Monero. And the main reason for that, as I'm sure you're well aware, is because although it does give miners the ability to increase the block size, they can only do that if they also increase the fees, right? So there's actually that economic component.
Yeah, that's one of the beautiful things, is if they choose to just arbitrarily increase the block size, they sacrifice subsidy, and so they have to make up for it in fees, or the game theory of financial incentives will break down for them, and they'll be burning money to be able to do so. It's a really fascinating system, and one not meant for just permanently increasing the block size, but handling short-term amounts of increased on-chain activity and then shrinking blocks back down to a size that's reasonable. It's a really interesting one. I don't want to get into the details, but I'm glad that you looked into it and covered it a bit too, because it's one that's been working very, very well in practice for a decade now. So circling back to this topic of ossification, I think maybe the harder thing to actually discuss, like I love the theory, but I'm really curious on what you think for, like, what are the real steps we take towards helping Bitcoin to continue to evolve? Like, I know you talked about block size in that presentation. We've talked a lot about covenants and other potential changes like opcat. You briefly mentioned the great script restoration, which we'll maybe get to a little bit more later with a listener question. But what are the, like, actual things that we can do? It feels like to me, like, every day it's getting murkier as to, like, how would I go about, hey, I have this perfect privacy Bitcoin improvement proposal. How do I get that done? Or is that something that's worth pursuing? So maybe just your thoughts on, like, what are the actual steps that we can take as people who want to see changes continue to happen in Bitcoin?
Well, part of the problem is that there is no well-defined process, and I would say there cannot be a well-defined process. Because ultimately, what does it all come down to? Rough consensus and running code. It's very hard to quantify. That's why it is rough consensus. But I think, you know, one potential problem is that there just hasn't been a improvement proposal that has gained significant momentum and collaboration from people. You know, it seems like it's always been like a few people over here, a few people over there. And really, you know, if you want to build consensus, there, it's kind of its own bootstrapping and network effect problem. You have to actually get boots on the ground and start talking to a lot of people and get them interested and get them, you know, devoting time into contributing to that idea and voicing support for it and trying to move it forward. And it seems like Jeremy Rubin was the last person who really tried to do that. And unfortunately, he rubbed some people the wrong way. It is kind of a delicate process, and it may even be the case that you should not champion your own proposal. You know, that I think some people may see that as a red flag in and of itself. So maybe if there's something that you really want, it's better for you to find other reputable people in the space to champion.
Yeah, I definitely can see that. And I feel like that's been part of the reason why the covenants discussion has been much more pressing. I mean, like, what Jeremy proposed CTV in like 2020, maybe 2021, but I think 2020. Mm-hmm. And only really now have we circled back to serious discussion around the concept of covenants, not necessarily just OpCTV. There's a lot of other proposals and OpCat now and great script restoration. But it feels like that's kind of happened because a lot more people in the space, not just the devs working on the proposals, are actually willing to talk about this stuff publicly and have conversations around it. I think that's definitely a key point. Yeah, rough consensus is very, very rough. And it does require almost like it's more a social aspect. Like, obviously the technical proposal has to be sound for there to be any chance. Obviously that's how it should be, but it ends up being more of a social effort than it is a technical one, once you have a good technical proposal. And that hurdle is just so high these days, it feels like.
Yeah, and here's a good example. So there was a panel at Lugano about OpCat, or at least it was about like covenants and layer twos. And there was like five or six people on the stage, all very, you know, well-known Bitcoin folks. And they all said that they liked OpCat. However, one of them said, I'm against it for social reasons rather than technical reasons, simply because they're pissed off with like Taproot Wizards and Udi and, you know, him going off and triggering people on social media. And I'm like, this is like the perfect example of this process going wrong, is, you know, you're letting your emotions get in the way of the sort of cold, stoic logic of looking at these things and how they're going to potentially improve the network.
Yeah, choosing based on if people you like support something and if people you don't like don't support something is a very interesting bar for what changes should happen to Bitcoin. But I have seen a lot of that. That's not a one-off case. Like, there's a lot of people who say, like, because this person supports it, I won't support it.
I also think that an appropriate description of Bitcoin consensus is it's like a non-Newtonian fluid. And this is where some of this delicate social nature comes in, is that, you know, if there's some unquantifiable velocity of force at which if you push too hard, then it turns into a brick wall. And so you just need to ease into it slowly and steadily, you know, slowly building consensus and getting your champions together to show that, you know, your proposal does not have any substantial objections.
Yeah, definitely seems like the way. And I think that might be one of the reasons why covenants have gotten further than I expect, is that it has been a kind of a low and slow conversation over the past few years that's just continued and slowly grown and grown. I would love to hear if there's any specific proposal or just general change or improvement that you're particularly excited for or particularly would want to see happen. Obviously, I know maybe there's some things that just can never happen that you would love, but maybe on the practical side, something that you think needs to happen in Bitcoin that you'd like to see adopted.
Yeah, there are many things. I think my highest priority at the moment would be basic building blocks that will help improve development of layer two networks. And so Opcat seems to be one of those. There's a few other opcodes out there that layer two developers seem to be in favor of. And, you know, whether that happens as a one-off or perhaps through the great script restoration, then I'm kind of ambivalent. I do like great script restoration because I feel like it would be better for us to just do a one and done, you know, just get it over with rather than fighting about sort of one-off opcodes here and there. If we can have, you know, one clean sweep of that, that would be great. Medium term, like over the next 10 to 20 years, I think the quantum computing issue is going to potentially reach a critical point. I gave a presentation about that a month or so ago. And it's, you know, it's sufficiently far away that I think people aren't concerned about it. But also, as we know, it's very difficult to change Bitcoin. And this particular change, I believe, is going to violate some principles of Bitcoin one way or another. The point being that if we're basically going to have to decide how to deal with non-quantum safe Bitcoin funds, Bitcoin UTXOs at some point. So, you know, we can start the process of agreeing upon like what the best quantum safe cryptography is that we should implement in Bitcoin. But even once we do that, and once we kick off the migration process, that will take years and years, I think, for people to actually migrate. And eventually, not everyone is going to migrate. And, you know, at least part of that is due to lost funds. And so then the real question is going to become, do we either sit on our hands and allow lost funds to be stolen by quantum adversaries? Or do we say at some point, okay, this has gone far enough, and we're going to do a soft fork to essentially make those funds unspendable. So one way or another, that's going to violate a principle of basically the principle of, you know, your keys, your coins. Either those coins are going to get stolen, even though the adversary didn't originally have the keys, or the keys will no longer be useful if that owner still has them.
Yeah, and like you said, that's something that has to happen so far ahead of when quantum computers are actually viable. So that's an interesting one that does need conversation sooner rather than later.
And so then, you know, even looking out further beyond that is more of the block space economic stuff of, how are we going to deal with the long-term thermodynamic security? And the main reason why I think that's important and so complicated is that there are too many variables and, in fact, you know, future unknown unknowns of the supply and demand of block space. And I think people might raise their eyebrows and say, well, what do you mean there's unknowns about the supply of block space? Well, that's where layer twos actually come into play. And layer twos and, you know, centralized providers is effectively, if a lot of adoption happens through centralized custodians, or if certain layer twos gain sufficient mass adoption, those things can actually effectively act like a block size increase from the economic perspective, as they are offloading a lot of demand from the base blockchain. So there's a lot of transactions that might have originally happened on the base blockchain that no longer happen. And so, you know, that, you know, can cause a drop in fees for miners. And simply because we don't know in the long-term future what all of these different variables of supply and demand are going to work out to, I think that having a static block size limit, whatever it is, like there is no magic number, I think, that is the right number. One of the main reasons that a lot of the block size proposals back in the day were dumb is that they were just magic numbers. I think in order to really fix this aspect of the game theory of Bitcoin as an ecosystem, that similar to how we have difficulty adjustments right now for the miners, I think we need to have block space adjustments that take into account all the different variables that can lead to a healthy or unhealthy environment for the economics of block space.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. I'm glad you pointed out things further down the line as well, because I think I can get kind of caught up in the current things, like just looking at covenant opcodes or something like that, and not thinking long term about what would this actually look like for quantum resistant crypto, for changing block size, something like that. And I'm glad you pointed out that there's no perfect block size. Like, I think there's this weird assumption that like either 4 megabytes is just perfect, like what we've chosen is somehow perfect and we should never change it, or that we know exactly what the size should be. Like, oh, we should have 1 megabyte block sizes or something. And I'm not really sure how people can think that they know exactly what the perfect block size is when we're talking hopefully hundreds or maybe even thousands of years in the future. There's no way to predict what it's going to look like.
It requires a great degree of arrogance. And also, I think that one of the reasons that we should desire an algorithm to adjust the block size or block space is that we want really what I'm calling Goldilocks. You don't want small blocks or big blocks. You want Goldilocks. And what are Goldilocks? I consider this to be block space that is set sufficiently low enough that there is constant fee pressure. You know, you're not getting basically free cheap transactions. And the reason why you want this constant backlog with a robust fee market is twofold and possibly more. One, of course, we need to pay the miners and we need to make this sustainable in perpetuity as the subsidy continues halving. And two, it actually incentivizes people to use block space efficiently. So, you know, if your blocks are too big, nobody is going to even bother building layer two solutions, at least not for like cheap transactions, maybe if there's other functionality. And if your blocks are too small and the fees are too high, then, you know, even that can cause problems where I foresee a potential future where even the layer twos have issues. So like, you know, layer twos need to be able to settle back onto the main chain. And let's envision a future where we do get enough protocol improvements that there is a really robust and vibrant, thriving layer two ecosystem, but the blocks are still really, really tiny. I could easily see game theory start to break down if the layer twos are the primary consumers of block space and they're all competing with each other over this. It's a type of, you know, pure free market capitalism, but that could be problematic and in fact ultimately harm the thriving layer two ecosystem. And you know, we're thinking like really out in the future right now. There's so many variables we're probably not even imagining. It's very difficult to even talk about, but I'm just trying to tease out some of the potential future problems. Because if we agree that natural ossification is a thing, then I think that if we wait so long until these problems actually become problems, then we may not actually be able to do anything to adjust course and be able to, you know, resolve them at the base layer.
Yeah, absolutely. I think like quantum computers are a great example of that, because if they're actually imminent, it's probably too late. It's too late for most people's funds. Maybe you can save some, but that process is going to take a long time. So I've got one last question for you, and then I have a bunch of really good listener questions that people dropped on X when I let them know that we were going to be talking about this. So last question that I have, we've touched on it a little bit throughout, but not in a really concerted way. So I just wanted to circle back. We touched on self-custody a little bit more, or like building better layer twos. But when we talk about privacy, what's your view around how that fits in? Like, can Bitcoin continue to be called freedom money if privacy is not approachable for the average person? Is that something that you view as essential as improving self-custody or ensuring that we can build proper, trustless layer twos? Where do you see that fitting into this conversation?
I mean, I think it's probably a lost cause to get what you might call strong privacy built into Bitcoin base layer, and that it's a better path forward for developers to build strong privacy onto second layers, because you have so much more leeway and flexibility in how you build them. And so that kind of goes back to, well, we need to actually make it easier for people to build second layers so that they can do that. And you know, it could get pretty interesting. You know, right now, even if you give up on the idea of sovereign Lightning Network as a like mainstream adoption thing for people to be using, I do think Lightning Network could easily have a place in the future of a vibrant layer two ecosystem of essentially acting as bridges between the different layer twos. And so that could get pretty interesting from a privacy perspective if you could hop between any number of layer twos trustlessly, instantaneously. Would that hopefully be able to greatly improve privacy? Of course, as we're well aware, the state of privacy on the Lightning Network continues to be explored, and weaknesses continue to be found, and we'll need to continue hardening it from that perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. So to summarize, basically, like, we need to enable better building blocks so that the scale of layers thing actually can become true is kind of the crux of it, and then we can do better privacy there.
So maybe this is controversial, but you know, one of the reasons why I don't really tell people to go use mixers is because I'm not convinced that that's going to be a sustainable long-term solution. I expect that, well, if the current course continues, that most people are going to get priced out of using mixers on chain, you know, unless we get other technical improvements that actually economically incentivize people to do mixing. I don't see that being sustainable long term.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree that they're really a short term band-aid, and if things happen to the fee market as people expect, it's not going to be a long term solution. And there's the double issue of they have traditionally either required very poor user experience or a centralized entity to help coordination. That's not necessarily a technical requirement, but that's how it's played out so far. And that makes them much more vulnerable than a more decentralized layer too. Yeah, man, a lot of different things going on here, but I feel like I got a lot more clarity out of our conversation. So thank you for our time diving through my questions. But if you're down, I've got a few listener questions that we can walk through and maybe just kind of do a rapid fire Q&A.
Sure.
Okay, awesome. You did touch on the great script restoration already a bit. Was there anything you wanted to add? Bob Somerville said, I would love to hear your thoughts on the great script restoration as a potential let's fix it all. I think you already pretty much answered that, saying that that's one of the reasons you like it. So you could kind of do it all in one go, but anything else you want to add there?
Yeah, so doing it all in one go. Also, the nice thing is that Rusty is really focusing on safety here, right? And so one of the major aspects and changes to the great script restoration is essentially you're coming up with a new way of kind of counting the computational resources required to execute a script. That's we've had a few kind of half-assed ways of doing that over the years by like counting signature operations and stuff, but that hasn't been able to capture all of the potential complexity of validating transactions. So you know, Rusty seems to be making good progress on that, and I think he actually just published a draft BIPT for it in the past week. So
nice.
You know, it still could be a year or several years away from happening, but I'll be keeping an eye on it.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll be seeing if you choose to champion it. It'll be interesting. See if we can get a collective together to push through something like that. It would be really, really enjoyable to have a lot more building blocks, especially now that I'm getting more on the Bitcoin dev side on chain and Lightning. It's been interesting trying to see what it's like to actually build more advanced solutions around it. The other main focus of really a couple questions was basically, what's your view on getting better privacy at the base layer? I know we just touched on this a little bit, but I want to shift the focus a little bit. So like Kai Abinerv, who's a dev in the Monero community, he asked, what's your stance on privacy, BIPs? If opt-in privacy could be added today, magically, for the computational and bandwidth cost of a Schnorr signature, would you add it? Or do you see privacy as best done by L2 solutions? I guess getting more to the theoretical, if you could have that, would you be behind it? Versus the pragmatic, which is probably that you wouldn't be able to get something like that through consensus.
I mean, even if you could, almost every privacy solution is once again beholden to the sort of network effect problem, right? So like, you know, the great quote of, you know, privacy only extends so far as the cooperation of one's peers. From that perspective, I think, and in a practical perspective, it might be better and more sensible to have layer twos, you know, specific protocols that are for privacy, so that you get more people over there using them. So to give a kind of counter example, I think that one of the best practical ways that we could improve Bitcoin privacy today without protocol changes would be to get everybody to use PayJoin. You know, it's already a thing. All we have to do is get people to actually implement that interactive protocol whenever you're accepting payments. But I don't think it's going to happen. You know, just asking people to do anything seems to be too high of a burden.
Yeah, the user experience hurdle is definitely the tricky part of gaining adoption there. And it's best when you can get privacy on accident. just using something for the user experience. I think that was one of the ideas behind how Lightning privacy would be helpful, is that people would use Lightning for cheaper transactions and they would necessarily get better privacy because you're not publishing every transaction on chain. And that is one of the good benefits there. The hard part is the user experience of Lightning hasn't quite lived up to expectations, but I think that's definitely an issue there, is the user experience getting there. I guess if you could do it in a perfect way where the user experience was just the same as making a standard transaction, you could probably get much better adoption. But if we're still looking at needing to move like coffee transactions to a second layer, base layer changes could help that bridge, like especially when you're moving funds into a layer two. That's one of the weak points right now of Lightning, is the on-chain footprint is quite detrimental unless you do things a very specific way. So those on-chain changes do help those layers that get built on top have better privacy in the bridging in and bridging out, or pegging in and pegging out scenario. But thanks for jumping on that one. Another one to get into, I think we already answered quite a few of these in just our conversations, but another one that's an interesting kind of thought experiment, and I think we'll probably end on this one, is if you could rewrite Bitcoin today as a brand new protocol, what would the core of it be? What are the core kind of differences that you would have in a Bitcoin that you think could solve the problems that we've talked about throughout today? It's a pretty general question, so just dive in. Maybe if there's one or two specific things that you would change if you had the ability to kind of wave a wand and build Bitcoin differently.
Yeah, that's a tricky one. I mean, there are a number of bugs in Bitcoin, right? There's this other project that's basically the Great Consensus Cleanup or something like that, which are just a bunch of outstanding edge cases and issues, and actually like safety issues, some of which are kind of related to, you know, block size debate and ensuring that people can't do sort of denial of service on nodes by constructing weird transactions and stuff. Yeah, Bitcoin, you know, the tricky thing is, as I said earlier, you really don't want to screw with the game theory. And so I think I would go back to really what we've already spent a lot of time talking about, which is like the one aspect of the Bitcoin game theory that I think needs improving is this sort of idea around block space economics. But that is a long-term problem. I'm not really convinced that there's anything at the protocol layer that would necessarily be a like 10x improvement for user experience and adoption. I think most of the friction around that just has to do with key management, and I don't have like a fundamental solution for like a protocol change that would fix a lot of the key management issues.
Yeah, that's one where it just comes down to that initial barrier of, are you willing to take personal responsibility? And that's always kind of going to be the barrier of entry here. We can minimize that and abstract it away as much as possible, but if you can't keep something secret, you can't use Bitcoin or anything like it. That'll always be kind of the lower bar that people have to be willing to jump over to be able to use these things. Awesome. Well, I think that's all of the main questions that I had. Like I said, I think we hit on the majority of these already in our discussions. So if you listeners asked a question and I didn't cover it, let me know and I'll see if I can get a text response or something from Lop. But I think we walked through the vast majority of it. So any last thoughts or kind of closing things you wanna bring up, Jameson?
Well, in closing, basically the same as in opening, which is the most important thing that we can do is continue talking about these issues. I think the most dangerous thing that we can do is be complacent, rest upon our laurels, you know, declare victory. Because if we declare victory today, I can assure you we will not retain a victorious position over the long term.
Very, very well said. Well, thank you so much for jumping on. Glad you were willing to do this, and glad we got to talk through what I think is one of the most pressing topics in the Bitcoin space right now. So hopefully this will help people better understand a lot of the thought process behind different views, and better understand kind of where we're coming from when we say that there are some good ways that we can make changes to Bitcoin to keep it a useful tool for freedom, to keep it freedom money. So thank you so much for your time, Jameson.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this episode of Opt Out. If you did, please take a moment and subscribe to the podcast, or if you're already subscribed, share it with one friend or family member this week. As always, you can check out the link to the guest content and contact info, as well as links to all of the tools we discussed in today's episode. Now get out there and opt out this week.